Remember to visit this course's website at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll find additional information about the lectures that you just heard. Once there, you can access this course by using the password 1132BDD. Again, that's 1132BDD. The Basics of Genetics, Lecture 11, Mutations.
This lecture is all about mutations, but actually, genetics as a course is a course about mutations. Mutations are that pivotal for the understanding of genetics. But right now, I want to go back to the roots of our understanding of mutations and then bring us up to the present again with some really interesting results that have been coming out of the Human Genome Project. I decided to go to the Oxford English Dictionary again and to the Ultimate Science Fiction Web Guide again, as I've done for some other words, to try to take a look at this word mutation. And I suggest you might want to do the same thing. It's a fun word to look up in a dictionary that will give you the full etymology and the full history of the word. So the word mutation sometimes has negative connotations. And I wanted to get into that a little bit because as someone who teaches genetics, I tend to think of it as mostly a positive phenomenon that has essentially given us all the wonderful variability that we see in organisms. Mutation has been used as a word since the 14th through the 18th centuries, meaning simply change. What sort of change? Well, if you look up this word yourself, you'll see that we can talk about changes in music or changes in government or changes in attitudes of people. So it was a synonym of sorts being used for change. And people like Chaucer used it and Shakespeare used it. So let's say that through the 14th to the 18th century, there was nothing particularly special about the word mutation, nor should there have been, at least nothing in a genetic context. In the 19th century, Wallace, who in parallel to Charles Darwin, was also thinking about how species evolved and also came up independently with a mechanism by which species might evolve. So Wallace is an interesting person, an interesting contemporary of Darwin, began to think about what he called geographical mutations. He was thinking about evolution, and he was trying to understand why it is that organisms vary the way they do. He was actually looking at islands and trying to understand why variation on one island was different from variation on another island. So that's maybe the first use of it. Also in the 19th century were some intriguing uses of the word mutation in the field of linguistics. And I say intriguing because some of the analyses that we do of DNA, strings of A, C's, G's, and T's, trying to understand their meaning, really fit into the field of linguistics, in my opinion. So people were starting to think about languages and how they've changed and starting to use the word mutation for that, which I think is a really intriguing sort of thing that was going on. People were also in the 19th century beginning to use it for paleontology. They were noticing gradual changes in fossils as they dug through the sediments and examined fossils. But it wasn't until 1901 that mutation was first used in the way that we are using it in this course. And it was by Hugo de Vries. And you might recall that Hugo de Vries was one of the people who rediscovered the basic rules of genetics and also at the same time rediscovered the original writings of Mendel. And Hugo de Vries was the first to really use the word mutation and mutant to try to put some sort of a word on what was going on with what he was understanding about genetics at that time. When did we begin to get negative connotations for the word mutation and mutant? Again, I think I'm going to evoke science fiction here. It's more than that. I think it's that there's always been a concern or distrust of anything that looks freakish or grossly abnormal. And so it actually wasn't too much of a stretch for science fiction writers to start to use the word mutation to play on people's fears of the abnormal and the unusual and the freakish. So, according to the Oxford English Dictionary in 1938, the first use of the word mutation in that kind of sense, that kind of scary science fiction sense, was in Astounding Science Fiction, a magazine that published a short story by Lane. But I think there are deeper roots, and I think we can go back to thinking about some of the 19th century literature that doesn't actually talk about mutations, but plays on our distrust and concern of the grossly abnormal. Think of Frankenstein. Think of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Think of the Island of Dr. Moreau. Now, none of these people use the word mutation, or the Oxford English Dictionary would have caught it for sure. But there was already a predisposition of anyone who was a reader, perhaps, or interested in literature, of the presentation of anything that looked abnormal. So the times were right to start to think of mutation in a negative sense. However, here's all a mutation is. A mutation is an allele, or a mutation can cause an allele. Remember, we talked about alleles. Alleles are just variant forms of genes. We have variant forms of genes all the time. Mutants are varieties. The reason that we have so many beautiful varieties of dogs and flowers and humans is because of mutations. I want to read a quote from a very early geneticist. This is in 1929. His name is Muller. I don't usually read quotes as long as this, but this is actually a beautiful quote. He is very, very excited about mutations that he is discovering for the first time in fruit flies. And he considers this to be nothing but positive, in my opinion. If I read through this quote, I see that he is delighted with what he is discovering, because he's realizing that he's really at the roots of genetics. So here's Muller in 1929 describing fruit fly mutants. All types of mutations, large and small, ugly and beautiful, burst upon the gaze. Flies with bulging eyes or with flat and dented eyes, flies with white, purple, yellow, or brown eyes, flies with curly hair and ruffled hair and parted hair, with fine and with coarse hair, and bald flies. Flies with swollen antennae or extra antennae or legs in place of antennae. Flies with broad wings, with outstretched wings, with truncate wings, with split wings, with spotted wings, with bloated wings, and with virtually no wings at all. Big flies and little flies, dark ones and light ones, active and sluggish ones, fertile and sterile ones, long-lived and short-lived ones. Flies that preferred to stay on the ground. Flies that did not care about the light. Flies with a mixture of sex characteristics. Flies that were especially sensitive to warm weather. The roots of life, the genes, had indeed been struck and had yielded. I love that quote of Muller that conveys the excitement that early geneticists had when they realized what they had in mutations. Where are mutations coming from? In a simple sort of sense, let's go back to the monks who were copying manuscripts. Remember, we talked about mutations in terms of simply substituting one letter for another, inserting a letter, deleting a letter. And we talked a little bit about some of the consequences of those. But let me run through in general what the consequences of mutations are. First possible consequence, nothing. There are plenty of mutations that occur, plenty of replication mistakes by the medieval monk copying the manuscript, in which there's really no substantial noticeable difference between the organisms, the one that got the mutation and the one that did not. Or lethality. Lethality is one of the problems that could occur, but one of the things to realize about that is that lethality is not an end in itself. It simply means that organism doesn't get to live with that mutation, but plenty of organisms that have less lethal versions or that are compensating in some way for that mutation are living. So I tend to try to put the lethal mutations into that context to really understand them. We don't have them with us. Those organisms are typically not with us anymore if it was truly a lethal mutation. And then you've got everything in between. You've got little tweaks to one or another of your enzymes. You've got big changes. You've got little changes. And the thing to understand is that all genes are mutant. We don't have with us the original set of genes from the origin of life that presumably by this definition are not mutant yet. All genes are mutant. And it's on a grand scale that we have mutations. Now, there's a different category of mutation that I'd like to talk about, especially now that we've already gone through talking about mitosis and meiosis. You're ready to hear about this new type of mutation. And you might have been wondering about it as I described the moving of things, the moving of boxes on moving day, the sorting of the boxes, the sending off of the boxes to the different households, the metaphor we were using for mitosis and meiosis. You might have been wondering, well, do we ever make mistakes? Is there ever a problem such that one of the new cells gets two of a particular piece of information, two chromosomes, two boxes of information? Is there ever a possibility where a box goes missing and a particular chromosome doesn't make it into the next cell? And the answer to that is yes, there are many, many examples of that. And those are called chromosome mutations because those are not mutations down on the level of the A's, C's, G's, and T's. Those are the big moving day level mutations where essentially boxes go missing, boxes of information or chromosomes of information go missing. And there are a couple of ways to describe these. There's a particular suffix that gets attached to the two types of mutations that I'm going to talk about, ploidy and somy. So if I say I have a triploid, it means I have three copies of the entire genome. It means that something went terribly wrong on moving day. I'm only supposed to end up with two copies of the entire genome, but I might end up with three copies. That would be a triploid state. If I accidentally ended up with four copies of the entire genome, another disastrous mistake on moving day in which all the boxes got sent over to one cell, I would be tetraploid. So that would mean I'd have four copies of the entire genome rather than the two copies that I should be ending up with if everything got moved correctly. So I'm not going to go into the exact details about how we get this, except that the names are intriguing and easily looked up and definitely for mammals, lethal. So we don't find triploid humans. We don't find tetraploid humans. Those would not last even past the very early embryonic stages. We do actually find a great many triploid and tetraploid and even higher pentaploid plants. It turns out for various reasons, plants are amazingly tolerant of having extra ploidies, extra copies of chromosomes. So I don't want to generalize too much about just how dramatic this particular mutation is. It is, but it really depends on which organism you're talking about, whether it's a lethal mutation, absolutely lethal mutation to have all those extra copies of chromosomes, or whether it's something that can be tolerated as it is with plants. Another suffix that we use is somy, and that's where we talk about individual chromosomes that have gone the wrong way on this moving day that we call meiosis. And so if I talk about a trisomy 21, tri means three, somy, trisomy 21, I mean I have three copies of chromosome number 21, trisomy 21. How did that happen? When things were being sorted out, one of the cells accidentally got an extra copy of chromosome 21. You can maybe imagine how that could happen. We've got a lot of boxes that are being sorted, and this one goes missing, and one of the cells ends up with too much of chromosome 21. Typically, somies are referred to in terms of chromosomes. So trisomy 21 is actually a very famous mutation, an important mutation. It's one of the same thing with Down syndrome. So another word for Down syndrome is trisomy 21. And that does have a phenotype to it. Those people are typically mentally retarded, but typically quite functional and you know, oftentimes are getting along just fine in on whatever level they're getting along. So you could call it a fairly major mutation, but certainly not a lethal mutation. Are there other somies for other human chromosomes? actually very few. It appears that humans don't have much of a tolerance for having extra copies of any of their various chromosomes. So there is no trisomy for chromosome number one. That would be lethal. And there's no trisomy for chromosome number two. Notice that chromosome 21 is going to be a very small chromosome. Remember, the chromosomes are in order. The biggest one is number one, next is number two, next is number three. By the time we get to chromosome 21, we're talking about a fairly small chromosome. It may be why we tolerate a trisomy to chromosome 21 and really don't tolerate somies or higher somy levels for the other chromosomes. There is one really interesting exception, though. The sex chromosomes, the X's and the Y's, are subject to interesting somies. So it is possible to have a sorting out of the X's and the Y's such that you end up with individuals who are, for example, XXY, two X's and a Y, or XXXY, and in rare cases that's a possibility, or individuals that are missing an X chromosome. So that's typically indicated as X0 to indicate that there's no X chromosome there, just one single X chromosome. There are possibilities of XYY, having two Y chromosomes. Let me tell you a little bit about what the consequences are of having those slight variations in the X's and Y's, those variations in somies for those particular chromosomes. If an individual has X's, say two or three X's plus a Y chromosome, they may show some ambiguous secondary sex characteristics and some ambiguous primary sex characteristics in some cases, and may also have some problems with sterility. It's actually difficult for cells to go through the kind of cell division they need to do to make sperm and eggs, to deal with extra somies like that, extra copies of chromosomes. So there may be some sterility problems too. So that's multiple X's with a Y, and that's called Klinefelter's syndrome. If an individual ends up with just one X and nothing in the second position, that's called Turner's syndrome. That person will look phenotypically female, but might be of shorter stature and might have some other more subtle characteristics that a doctor would be able to determine. The interesting thing about Turner syndrome women with XO is that they do have some challenges probably around the whole problem with X inactivation. If you recall what we were talking about with X inactivation, one or the other of the X's gets shut off early in embryonic development. And that may be one of the problems that Turner syndrome women encounter. In some cases, there may be non-functional X chromosomes in some of their cells. There's also a possibility of having an X with two Ys. And in some cases, those are men that are taller than average, although taller than average, there are a lot of ways to get that genetically. That's not necessarily a major indicator phenotypically. And there have been studies of men with extra Y chromosomes, some of them fairly controversial as to how they were carried out, some of them suggesting the possibility that there may be more XYY men in prison compared to out in the general population. Now, I want to be careful with the causality there. I'm not saying that XYY men are predominant in prison. I'm just saying if you counted up the numbers inside and out, some studies have suggested that possibly there's a slightly greater frequency in prison. But I also want to say those studies were controversial, and it's always a delicate matter to start to talk about people's behaviors, especially when behavior can be so important. Nonetheless, I bring these up in case you'd like to look into XYY and kind of read about it and see what's new with that and evaluate for yourself, you know, whether the studies were done in the right way. Now, there's an additional interesting word that I want to introduce you to, and that is aneuploidy. An coming from the Greek meaning not, you, E-U, good, ploidy, not a good ploidy, aneuploidy. What does that mean? Well, it means that something has happened such that the division of information into the new cells has been extremely careless, so that we have extra copies of some genes and not of others, extra copies of some chromosomes, rather, and not of others. This sounds like a disastrous situation. It only really happens as far as we know, in particular cases, but particularly interesting cases, that is, cancer cells can often become aneuploid. And it's not fully understood why this is and whether it's aneuploidy that exacerbates cancer or whether it's some other aspect of cancer that seems to cause aneuploidy. There's not a particular causality that's been sorted out for this, except to say that cancer cells, which already divide in a kind of a careless way and without regard to surrounding cells and in many cases out of control compared to what other cells are doing, also tend to be aneuploid. That is, the carelessness with which they sort out their chromosomes results in having strange numbers of chromosomes. And it doesn't seem to matter too much because, remember, cancer cells are not necessarily about fitting in with the rest of the cells of the body. They're really off on their own particular, you know, cancer agenda. And in this case, aneuploidy seems to go along with that. The other interesting place that aneuploidy occurs is with cells that are in culture. You might remember that in the 1950s, humans began to understand how to take individual human cells, say, for example, from my arm, they might take some skin cells, get them onto a petri dish, and get them dividing, almost as though they were little single-celled organisms. And this is a very powerful thing in research to be able to have human cells in culture. One of the interesting things that happens with many cell cultures, though, is that the cells become aneuploid. Okay, same as cancer cells do. And there are some connections because cells on petri dishes really do not have to coordinate with the body. There is no body. They don't have to coordinate within a particular organ or within a particular tissue type in many cases. And so some lineages of cells in culture have become aneuploid so that if you take a close look at them under the microscope and count up the chromosomes, you see bizarre numbers of chromosomes, and yet they seem to be able to go along. When I said that changes in ploidies are often fatal, or in fact always fatal, in a human, it's not necessarily the case at all for a cancer cell of a human or for a human cell in culture. By the way, speaking of cell culture, there is a very interesting set of cells that was begun in 1951. It was, in fact, the first major set of cells to be put into culture from a human called the HeLa cells, H-E-L-A. They were isolated from a woman who was to remain anonymous. So for many, many years, they were called Helen Lane. HeLa was said to be referring to Helen Lane, which turned out to be a pseudonym. They were isolated from her right after she died of cancer. These were some of her cancer cells. A little bit of a controversy as to whether this was done with her permission or not, or whether this was done with her knowledge or not. Later, it was found out that her name was actually Henrietta Lacks. So HeLa actually stands for Henrietta Lacks. And this is a famous lineage of cells that's used all over the world. And it's also very aneuploid. And there's some question recently about whether if I have some HeLa cells where I am and you've got some HeLa cells across the country where you are, do we really and truly have the same HeLa cells? Because there's been so many different changes in the ploidies such that these cells are highly, highly aneuploid. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about the naming of mutations. And there are a number of interesting challenges with naming a mutation. One is that many, many names of mutations are backwards. And this is one of the hardest concepts for my students in genetics to get sometimes. For example, if I say I have a gene for cancer, what I really mean is I have a gene for cell division, and that I spotted it because I spotted a cell dividing wrong. That is, when a cell divides incorrectly, when a cell divides inappropriately, we might be on our way to having a cancer cell. So a lot of cell division genes, a lot of genes that are about making cell division go through correctly, get named as cancer genes because we don't notice them until they go wrong. It would be a little bit like going back to the cookie factory, taking that dough-making machine in calling it the mixing machine that doesn't mix dough correctly, because that's the first time we noticed it. That's the first thing we noticed about it. We didn't notice it when it was functioning correctly. It's one of the ironies of trying to understand genes is we don't typically see easily that which is moving smoothly along in coordination with all of the other genes. The other problem with naming is that we're obliged to make overly simple names in some cases. We simply don't have room to name a gene with a whole sentence or paragraph worth of information. We're obliged to come up with one name for it. And therefore, again, you get genes that are named the cancer gene or, you know, the breast cancer gene. And it's often overly simple and therefore misleading as to what the full picture might be. And by now you have an idea that the full picture is really a wonderful multi-step pathway with amazing coordination. The other problem with naming of genes, and we encounter this a lot, is that the original idea of what a particular mutation was about was wrong. But we nonetheless had to name it. And now that name is permanently in the literature, and we're obliged forever after to call that particular mutation by this particular name, or to confuse the literature. And scientists are very, very cautious about changing names such that the literature becomes difficult to follow. Another problem with gene names, and this is one that unfortunately is very much with us now that we have so many genome sequences analyzed, is that we run out of English language words or any words at all that we can use. There's just simply too many genes to name, and people begin to use acronyms. And many of those acronyms become great long nonsense words unto themselves and really fall into the category of the sort of jargon that makes it really difficult for a layperson to feel comfortable talking about particular genes. That's an unfortunate consequence, but more and more we're encountering acronyms in gene names. Which brings me to fruit fly gene names. And fruit fly gene names have very interesting tradition. Now, remember, I read you aloud the beautiful quote from Muller. So you can see that the fruit fly people are already off on their own particular little tangent in respect to mutations. They've had a long tradition of naming their particular mutants in fanciful ways. I'm actually going to give you some examples so you can really enjoy these names. And this tradition even becomes a little bit competitive. Who can come up with the most wonderful name for the brand new mutation? In some labs, some fruit fly labs have even been known to have a set of really great names in reserve in hopes that they might encounter a fruit fly mutant that would match up to the name. So that's how amazing this particular naming system is. And it's not true for any of the other major model organisms. This doesn't happen with human mutations. It doesn't happen with the mutations for E. coli or for any of the other important model organisms. But fruit fly people are really off in their own particular world with this. So just for fun, I'm going to read you some names of some of the most fun fruit fly mutants. There's Tin Man. Tin Man has no heart in the embryonic stage. That's lethal, of course. But if you wanted to study the heart in embryonic stages, you'd be studying Tin Man. There's Methuselah, which is a long-lived fruit fly. There's Van Gogh, which has a swirling hair pattern on its wings. There's Grim Reaper, which is a cell death mutant in which some of the cells in the fly die. There's Cleopatra, which has an interaction with another gene mutation called ASP. There's Stranded at Second. That's the name of a mutation, Stranded at Second, that dies in the second instar of its larval stage. There's Amontillado, as in cask of Amontillado. It's unable to hatch from its egg. It's essentially walled into its egg. There's Swiss cheese that has holes in its brain. There's Lava Lamp that has movements of Golgi bodies, which are little tiny cellular structures that look like a lava lamp. There's Indy, I-N-D-Y. It stands for I'm Not Dead Yet, for a long-lived mutant. And there's Yippee, which was discovered by a graduate student who was relieved to be able to discover that particular mutation and thus presumably finish her thesis. So that, but to show you what the fruit fly community is like, they said, yep, Yippee is okay. It's going to stand as the name of a fruit fly. They also have whole sets of names. For example, there are a bunch of genes that block the communications between neurons, and those are called roadblock, gridlock, Sunday driver, and red tape, and others. So the laboratories that work on these often come up with a bunch of names that they're going to use for future mutations in hopes of discovering those actual mutants. One sad thing, though, the fruit fly genome is done, and it's got 25,000 genes, and they are being annotated faster than anyone can come up with fanciful names for them. So more and more, even the fruit fly people are starting to use acronyms to describe their particular genes. And perhaps this will be something in the past that genes used to be named in such fanciful ways with these. Now, one last problem with naming of genes is now that we have so many different major genomes done, there has been a discovery that what human genome experts call one name is being called a different name in fruit flies and being called a different name in some little worm and being called yet a different name in rodents, for example. And it will be a major challenge to bring together the multiple levels of jargon so that we have a cohesive picture of some of the major genes. So it's a challenge, and it's a challenge that's going on right now, that the various groups working on the various model organisms need to come together and decide on some sort of a nomenclature for many of the genes that their various organisms have in common. That's a challenge that's ongoing and is unfolding right now as people decide what to do about that. Now, I want to switch a little bit to a very interesting book I read that I will recommend to you at the end of this chapter. J. Craig Venter wrote his autobiography, A Life Decoded, describing lots of things about his life, but in particular, he was the person in charge of the private enterprise that was competing to complete the human genome. So he was one of the first people, along with the project that was going on by the United States government, to complete a human genome. What was believed at the time was that the DNA that was being sequenced by Venter's enterprise was from volunteers that worked for him. So a mixture of DNA had been put together from various people, anonymous, who had volunteered to hand over some DNA to be sequenced so that they would be anonymously part of the first human genome sequence to be produced by Venter's enterprise. The surprise that came out later and that he describes in his autobiography is that actually most of the DNA was his. And he justifies that by saying that one of the easiest ways to get a hold of some DNA is to get a hold of some sperm. So ultimately, they were probably going to do a man, even though they had a bunch of volunteers who were females as well. And for one reason or another, he explains it, it turns out to be mostly his DNA that was sequenced. So that's fine, but it actually makes for a very interesting autobiography. I think this is a first in autobiographies. It has to be a first in autobiographies. He calls himself the first chemical machine to gaze upon his own sequence. The first chemical machine to gaze upon his own sequence. And throughout his autobiography, he has boxes of information concerning his own genome and what it could possibly mean in terms of particular mutations that he was looking for. And what I wanted to do to conclude this lecture is tell you a little bit about Craig Venter's mutations and what he says about them. And then I would suggest that if you would like to read that book, you could do it by just looking at the boxes where he describes his mutations, or you can actually read all the other print that's in it as well. Here's one example that he talks about. He happens to have a version of something called the APOE gene. There are those acronyms that we're stuck with for gene names. The APOE gene that confers an increased risk of Alzheimer's. And he knows he has one copy of it. He's glad he doesn't have two copies, but he knows he has one copy of it. So what's he doing about it? Well, he's watching his diet, he's exercising, and he's using a fat-lowering drug, he says. He also has a risky variant of something called SORL1, which also confers an increased risk of Alzheimer's. So again, he's working with that with diet and exercise and fat lowering. He looked into something called FTO, which is one of the genes that can cause obesity, and there are many of those, and he found out that he was low risk for that. He looked into a gene that causes people to be novelty-seeking and thrill-seeking in some of its versions. It's called DRD4. It's a dopamine receptor gene. And he says that he was surprised to find that he does not have the risky variant for this, in spite of all the details that we get of him racing boats and doing all kinds of other daredevil things. He looked into his risk for high blood pressure. That's the GNB3 gene, and he found that he had the higher risk version of that. And again, it's diet, exercise, and fat-lowering drugs. What I want to point out about this, there are about 20 or so genes that he goes through. I won't read you all of them, but what I want to point out is what he's doing about it. It's no more than what your doctor would tell you to do if you put on the blood pressure cuff and found out that you had slightly higher blood pressure. It would be diet, exercise, and perhaps a fat-lowering drug. So the interesting outcome is that he has highly detailed information about particular mutations that he is carrying that give him predispositions. Remember, that's the right word for this, predispositions for particular conditions. But ultimately, what he's doing about it is fairly mundane, no more than what you or I would do if we suspected that we had something like this in our family. Anyway, it makes a very interesting read, I think, and it's a real first in autobiographies to have someone actually run through the list of all of their mutations as part of that. In the next lecture, we're going to begin a new topic, and that is how genes are regulated.
This ends Lecture 11.